Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome to Real GM Radio. I'm Daniel Rue, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. My guest is Dan Feldman of Dunked on Prime and the Daily Dunks, and Dan's a great guest for this, I mean, he's a great guest all the time, but a great guest for this window where we talked about the NBA Finals, takeaways from Game 1, where the series could move beyond that, a little bit of big picture on Denver and Miami, but then also the coaching carousel and some off-season topics as well, because June is that transition point of the culmination of one season and the beginning of the offseason and the draft, of course, as well. So we get into all that. This episode is brought to you by FanDuel. You can go to FanDuel.com/Boston and get a no-sweat first bet of up to $1,000. This episode runs a little bit under an hour. Lots of great stuff in here. I hope you enjoy it. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
We're recording this on Friday after Game 1 of the NBA Finals occurred last night, and I think there's more pressure or like more inclination to overreact than underreact to a Game 1 of a series, especially a final series. Was there anything that you took away from Game 1 that you're like, oh, this is really going to shape where we go from here?
I think the Nuggets have been better than the Heat all year, a better team overall. They were better in the regular season. I think they've been better throughout the playoffs, as good as Miami has been in the playoffs. I think if you just look at these teams of what they've been, the Nuggets are the better team. Sometimes different matchups happen. Sometimes it's more complicated than that. But I guess my biggest takeaway from Game 1 is the Nuggets still look like the better team, and it looks like that's going to matter a lot.
It's also kind of along those lines, the idea that you can't, it's very, very difficult, if not functionally impossible, to put out all of the fires that they cause when Denver is on offense, because the amount of attention that Jokic necessitates, that's extra eyeballs, that's extra physical position, and A, he's such a good passer, and B, they have other really good players that you're going to do it. Now, it's not going to be Aaron Gordon layups and dunks every time. It wasn't after the first quarter, but it's going to be something. And I had thought about it for the series. It's part of why I picked, and I said this on the Dunked On Pod preview, that I was like, I was close to picking the series in five. And it's out of respect for the Heat and everything that they've, and their coaching and their players, that I went with six. I still think that. I still think that that's some of the tension there. But you did see part of the idea that Denver's so good offensively, and Miami, they're, you know, it sort of reminds me of some of those series that the modern Raptors have played, where it's like, oh crap, they just need to be consistent on offense. Oh great, you're asking them to do the thing that's maybe the hardest for them to do.
Yeah, the Heat's offense was very disappointing. I thought they could have put more stress on Denver. Jimmy Butler in particular was passive, might be a little strong, but not as aggressive as the Heat need him to be.
I think passive is fair, personally.
Yeah. I mean, I think maybe not having the ball as much, trying to go get the ball. And there was a degree of that, but a lot of times it was when he had the ball, even times where he still shot, like settling for jumpers when I thought he could have pressured the rim. Yeah, they were just, look at Bam Adebayo. What, he ended up with 25 shots. I think a lot of times the Heat need Bam Adebayo to be more aggressive, but even him, a lot of those shots he wasn't playing with the force I'd like to see from him offensively. I know this is like a longstanding gripe. This is not a new thing. But that he could still get up 25 shots and not often enough play with the force, be settling for, you know, short mid-range jumpers, some of which are good shots, some of which are kind of I do think there's a lot more room for the Heat offense to return some of that pressure. And here is the you mentioned Aaron Gordon in the first quarter. This was a frustrating thing for Miami. The idea of, okay, you're going to go small. You're going to have this disadvantage. You're going to be the smaller team. You have this disadvantage against Aaron Gordon. And he exploited that. Great, great for him. But you got to make him pay on the other end. If you're going smaller and you're not getting more offensive skill out there to make him pay on the other end, that was you're not getting the trade-off at all. That was something that really backfired for him. I mean, that won't necessarily be the case next time. Like, you know, Max Strus isn't always going to shoot 0 for 9 on threes. Duncan Robinson isn't always going to shoot 1 for 5 on threes. But in this game, the trade-off just was not there at all.
Yeah, I think that's a completely reasonable way to put it. And what I've struggled with, you know, kind of going forward, I like that you brought up, like, with Jimmy, and Bam, that was a career high in terms of field goal attempts in a game for him. It was something that a viewer, I guess is the right word, noted on playback and then went back and looked, and he was at the precipice then and then, got over it. And our colleague Seth Partnow's play better adjustment is obviously going to be a part of this story. But like I brought up this idea briefly, and I think it's where I'm leaning right now, is the idea of like where the equilibrium is in the series. I think it's hard to argue against the concept that this was a more positive result for Denver than the average. But how much more positive is a key question.
Yeah, I think it was, well, when you say than average, than the average expectation, or than the average baseline of what these teams actually are?
Both, but you're right that it could, like, so, I mean, I could see this as, you could make an argument that on a neutral court, this is a Denver plus three series, let's say. Or I guess it would be minus with the way odds work. Denver, 3-point favorites. And then if you add in home court, and then you add in the rest advantage, like, with the final result, it actually gets kind of closer to that. But I would be, you know, you could persuade me to say that it's more like a Denver 5-point favorite series or something like that, and then you do get closer.
Yeah, I mean, and then on top of it, as we're forecasting out, now the Heat have to win 4 out of 6, not 4 out of 7. Like, Denver banking one is a giant deal. Yeah, I'll just go back to, I think the Nuggets are the better team. I will say, I think the Heat can defend better. I think the Heat are an incredibly tough and resilient team. I don't think they're going to back down. You and Nate talked a good bit on Dunkdown about whether the Heat were correct to kind of unveil their different defensive strategy late, and was it worth it, right? In a game where it looked like, yeah, it's going to be tough to come back, and do you want to save this for game two? But on the other hand, you also want to know whether it's going to work. You want to get a sense of it, but you let the Nuggets prepare now too. And my main thought is, yeah, it was late to come back, but did you see some of those comebacks against the Bucks? Like, this team is not out of it. They don't.
And Denver gave up some leads too.
Yes. Great point. So I think the Heat will have all those things going in their favor, but it's just really, really hard to overcome being the lesser team. Like, how often do we look back on any playoff series, but especially in the NBA Finals, and say, like, you know what? I think the lesser team won. You know, I'd say 2016, when the I know the result, and I give the Cavs all the credit for it, but I still think the Warriors were the better team. I think 2019 was debatable. I think the Warriors were more vulnerable than people think, and the Raptors were better than people think. Maybe that series is a toss-up to me in hindsight in terms of who's the better team. So I'm not necessarily counting that one as where the lesser team won, but it's rare. So that, I think, I mean, look, it's also possible. It's also possible we see the rest of the series and say, you know what, that was one game. And then we go, you know what, we were wrong. The Heat actually at this moment in June 2023, regardless of whatever, everything that happened before, like, we understand that, using that as context, but seeing where these teams are, we might end the series thinking the Heat are the better team. But at this point, I'd be very surprised by that. I think the Heat can win the series, but actually getting to a point where we view them as being better than the Nuggets, I'd be surprised, though I don't think it's impossible.
I like that framing of it, and I think that the better team versus the winning team is, it's nuancey, but it's good nuance. And I mean, the other thing that can change things, obviously, is injury. But another takeaway that I had from game one, and this is not exactly new, is Jamal Murray's relative size. You know, like, that he's being a little bit bigger. I think that works reasonably well. I don't know if that's why Jimmy Butler wasn't hunting him as aggressively as I thought was going to be a huge through line in the series, and I still think is going to be a huge through line in the series. But, like, Denver has, despite having generally like mediocre rim protection, MPJ may have one of the better rim protecting games I've ever seen from him in game one. They have really good positional size kind of all around. And they have players like Kentavious Caldwell-Pope and Bruce Brown when he plays, who can defend kind of above their listed height because they're strong. And that gives Miami not only fewer places to attack, but it gives Denver some places to attack Miami. It's not, as I mentioned, going to be Aaron Gordon every time, but they have these different kind of like smaller level competitive advantages. But the bigger reason that matters is because Jokic, not only is he a competitive advantage even in and of himself, but one of his best attributes is his ability to identify and time out when the best time to strike on that is. And so, like, he wasn't making the passes to Murray or to Gordon or to MPJ when they were in a bad spot. Like, it's sort of like a good quarterback, or you could draw comparisons in pretty much any other sport that's more collaborative, of putting your teammates in a position to succeed.
I'm glad you brought up Denver's size. I don't think this is breaking news to everyone, but I do think overall there's still some lingering misunderstanding of how modern basketball has changed. There was talk, I don't know, let's say circa 2015, a lot of this was with Draymond Green at center, of the trend was going smaller. Teams were going smaller, going smaller. We heard that, but that was just a shorthand for describing what was really happening. Teams were going more towards skill and quickness, but especially skill and shooting. And at that time, a lot of the bigs, they couldn't shoot, they couldn't dribble, they weren't as skilled. And so the way to get more skilled was to go smaller. But it wasn't about being shorter. There was no actual advantage to being shorter. It's still basketball. Like, go out and play basketball. You play with taller people, you're at a disadvantage. You play with shorter people, you're at an advantage. Basketball height matters. And so I think in these last few years, we've seen this new revolution where the big players are getting more skilled. You know, we talk about Aaron Gordon, right? Like, he fills this role on the Nuggets. But look what he at least dabbled in with the Magic. For somebody who's like the quote unquote energy hustle guy, he is incredibly skilled. Well, he's an incredibly good shooter for that role, for that archetype.
He's not the same physically as he was then, but Michael Porter Jr. was one of my favorite on ball players above 6'8" ever when he was in high school. And
what is he now, like 6'10", 6'11"? Like, having this size, he's so skilled. Like, having, so Denver is like the prototype of Nikola Jokic in a lot of voices. A point guard, and we know what his size is. So the Nuggets are reaping the size advantages without losing on skill. I do think maybe this team gives up a little bit in speed, where some of the smaller teams, or what we would have described as the shorthand of the smaller team, where those teams focus a little more on speed. I don't know if the Heat are going to be the team to take advantage of that. So it's not exactly perfect, but I think in a copycat league, if the Nuggets win, that's kind of going to be one of the big takeaways, is we can have size and skill.
Absolutely. And one other potential takeaway from this series, and this could be potentially like an exception that makes a new rule, which is, for a long time, I've had this idea, then part of the reason I've believed in like the value of defense is because you could think about the idea that how situations, both the improved opponent talent and scheming and everything else, like how that puts pressure on a team's offense. And so that means that, you know, you need to defend at a high level. It doesn't mean, like, my theory has always been that you need to be elite on one end and at least pretty good, ideally very good on the other. But it had been for me, like, it's better in some ways if that's on defense, the elite, because that travels and everything else. What Denver could be doing here, and this, I think of this, this might be, you know, it's funny you brought up Draymond, of like the element that all these teams try to copycat and absolutely fail, is Jokic might just be so good offensively, and especially with, like, you compare his size to Stephen Curry's or one of these other, Luka or anybody else, is that maybe it does work the other way. Maybe if you're so good offensively that even the best teams can't slow you down enough, that your defense can be pretty good and at times very good, and you can totally make it work. And I've been skeptical of those teams. It's a part of why I haven't been as outright about it as Nate has, in part because of this idea that the game is always changing, that it's better, especially for a center, to be, you know, great defensively than offensively. But we might be seeing a I probably it would be a temporary paradigm shift the other way.
All right, so let me challenge you on this, and you are correct. You have not been as far out on that line of thinking as Nate, and to me, that's what I'd rather pose this question to Nate. But I think you guys are congruent on this, so I'm curious your answer.
Sure.
I don't want to stop me if I'm paraphrasing this wrong, but you said a lot of skepticism about winning it all with a player like Jokic because of his defensive limitations. And I think I saw this might have been in his Discord chat for Dunked On Prime subscribers the other day. I saw Nate say something recently along the lines of, you know, I saw you had to have your best player a different way, a big, you know, superstar wing or Steph Curry at guard, like a shooter like that. We can have the defense behind him. But the game has changed enough where somebody like Jokic can be the best player now. And my question is, what's changed? Like, has the game changed? Has the style of play changed? Have other teams changed? Have the rules changed? What's changed? Or is it just that they're like, if Nikola Jokic came around, you know, 8, 7, 6 years ago at this level, right? If he were peaking, if he were at this point at then, like, why couldn't he have done it then? Or is it just like, hey, the best players happen to be wings, happen to be Steph Curry. And so that's why we looked at those players. It just happened not to be a center. Like, was there something systematically preventing this from happening earlier? Or is it just it happened to be there was no center good enough at that time, and now is Nikola Jokic's time?
It's a little bit unfortunate Nate's not here to defend himself, because, again, he did go out there. And part of his argument that he's still making now, which I do not necessarily agree with, is the idea that part of the reason Jokic is viable is because the quality of opponent is worse, like the idea that there isn't a team like the Warriors. But the part of it that I agree with is there is, I brought up that like elite versus very good concept, is that a team with Jokic as their center is probably not going to be elite defensively. And that's okay. And so what I'm positing is that that doesn't matter as much, but, and here's the but, if there were a team that could both score, let's call it close to as efficiently as Denver, but had the personnel to also be very good defensively, like, you know, peak Warriors. Like, would peak Warriors be the Nuggets?
Or even last year's Warriors.
Last year's Warriors would be a more I mean,
they put Jokic in the mix.
They put Jokic, but last year's Nuggets were significantly worse than this year's Nuggets because of all the lack of availability.
Yes.
Gaming out that series would be tough. Like, I actually think there's probably more of a chance than some would think that the Nuggets win it, in part because of the criticisms I've levied on Kerr over the years that he's too slow to adjust. And so, like, you could see, like, the Warriors not going to their best stuff really early and that creating huge problems. But to answer your basic question, one of the big things that changed is me and the way that I think about these. And so that would that have worked? Yes, if you didn't have a historical anomaly team. You know, like, so
the big thing.
Yeah.
Is I think the 15 to 18 Warriors were an all-time great team. You can't just say, like, oh, to win a title, you always need to beat a team like that.
There's exactly. And like so here's the game that we haven't played that I think is the most compelling. What about this year's Nuggets against that era's Cavaliers teams? So we're taking out the historic anomaly team. The Cavs were damn good. And, like, you know, they did, and they won a championship during the time they had an all-time player in LeBron for most of those years. And we shouldn't include the non-Kyrie year anyway, because the Cavs weren't as good then. And it's hard. It's funny because Kevin Love is theoretically on both this year's Heat and those Cavs teams and didn't play at all. It's also a worse Kevin Love now than it was then. My inclination is that those Cavs teams couldn't have stopped this Nuggets team. It would have been, so basically the question would have been, and those Cavs teams had, you know, they could pick up their defense. Like, it wasn't always every possession of the regular season, but they could get there. But Jokic is, the strain he puts on each individual defender, and more specifically in some ways your help defenders, like, that was never something I loved about Cleveland. Like, the idea of, like, they had guys, you know, they had some guys that could, and LeBron, of course, unbelievable. And he would have been able to function potentially as more of a rover, as he did at times in those series against the Warriors. Like, I mean, the stretch, one of the most underappreciated things about LeBron James is his defense in games 4 through 7 of that 2016 series.
Yeah.
Rather than the offense, which was, of course, unbelievable. I think that's a tough series to predict. And remember, these are basically contemporary teams. Like, it's the league is different now, but it's not that different. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think whoever wins the championship this year is not necessarily the weakest champion ever, but on the scale of these things, a relatively weak team, just how things shook out. Not to take anything away from them. Please don't take it that way. I give all the credit to, you know, you win a title, you win a title, right? And I'm going to make a brief aside before I answer your question. I think, especially as we go toward parity, but I've thought this before, there's a lot of value in being really, really good year after year after year. Are the Nuggets going to be the best champion ever? No. But this is not their first year being really, really good. You keep giving yourself chances. Some year you might win a title, so that works out for you. As far as your question, I don't know. I think it's close. So I think the Nuggets or Heat, if they win, would be on the lower end of quality of team for an NBA champion. I also think the Cavaliers of that era would be on the higher end of a team for that didn't win a championship. So I think you cross those and they're pretty close. But I think that gets to your larger point of, hey, if we're kind of considering that somewhere near a toss up, that probably gives more credence to a team built like the Nuggets with a player like Jokic. Although I don't know how much we can say a player like Jokic. He's unique with Jokic. A team like that is championship worthy. I thought those Cavaliers teams were championship worthy. They did.
Sure.
They won one of the four.
Except 18.
I disagree. I mean, overall, during the season, that team had a lot of problems. But wasn't it, maybe I'm getting this crossed up, wasn't 2018 in game one? That was the J.R. Smith game. That was 2018.
Oh, it
right?
might have been.
LeBron was incredible.
Like, there were so many, they played so many years in a row, I might be crossing them up.
So 2018 was like the worst regular season. I think that was the year they were like a four seed. But by the time they got to the finals and LeBron was ready and he knew what the challenge was in front of him, and to get that team in, what, like, he broke his hand after the game. He punched the whiteboard. So it wasn't quite the same. But just even one game against that awesome, awesome Warriors team, to get that game to overtime, I think that 2018 team was right up there with 17 and maybe a small step behind 15, although maybe up there with 15.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot to consider. I was also thinking about this. This is another one of those brain breakers. This Nuggets team against the 21 Bucks. it's just a series that very well could have happened if a few things had been shaken, you know, had health wise and everything else.
And I think that's just the larger point. Yeah, I don't know who'd win that. We can put them on this on a similar tier. I think what we're saying, though, is sometimes there'll be a team like the Warriors who are just insanely good and very hard to beat. Although a brief salute to the Rockets for coming closer. Well, I guess the Cavs did beat them, too. So
sure. That's the closest Rockets. Anyone can, because they did it.
Right, right. And occasionally there'll be a team like that where it just takes everything and you've got to figure out how to beat that one team and have everything go right, and you could do it and play out of your mind and it works. But a lot of years we're talking about a team like the Nuggets, or we're talking about those Bucks, or we're talking about that era's Cavs. Like, and it's all just, hey, you can mix and match a little bit and say this matchup or that matchup, and some teams are going to stress some more than others, and some are going to cruise. It's just going to be a little more matchup dependent, a little more luck dependent. And again, I'd want to just be really good year after year after year and give myself multiple chances to catch those right breaks like the Nuggets have done.
And that ties in with the idea, and it was the 21 Suns that got this idea of, like, the team that has, it's the healthiest team in the mix. And so there's value to being in the mix every year, being a viable team, because you never know how things are going to shake out. That could be you face unhealthy opponents like the Suns did during their run to the NBA Finals, and we thought maybe more in the NBA Finals, except Giannis was able to come back and be so awesome. Or it could be opponents get knocked out, and whether that's because in a case like Miami where they got outplayed, or there's bad luck or anything else that happens, like that, the one of the weirder examples of that that didn't end up materializing was like Philly facing the Hawks. It's just that the Hawks beat them. Like, that can happen too. And so for Denver, and it will get lost in the shuffle how, because especially due to Jamal Murray's injury, they would have been a more persistent conference finals at minimum team over this early part. I think this might be the early part of their run. I mean, early to middle. Like, it could extend another 4 or 5 years. You never know. It can end at any time, but it could also, I mean, when you have a generational talent, it can run a long time too. So that, like, the beginning of it won't look as strong focusing on results, because they weren't whole for a lot of that time. And that's the way things go. Like, it's more just a lingering perception. It's sort of like when a player misses some games and doesn't make an All-NBA team, and so you don't think they, like, years later, you're like, oh, were they that good that year? And it's like, yeah, they were. They just missed some time. So I think that's a part of it. But yeah, where this team fits in with the other champions is, if they get there, is such a fascinating question.
Yeah, it's interesting whether this is early in the run or not. I mean, look, at they made the conference finals in 2020, and I think a lot of people chalk that up as fluky. But, you know, in the last few years, more often than not, they've won at least one playoff series. And, you know, they've sometimes run into teams that give them trouble because I do still think, despite all the success, Nikola Jokic does have some real defensive flaws that the right teams that are good enough can take advantage. Now, that's what you want to do. I think this is what you're getting to earlier on, was the Nuggets have just become so good that the number of teams that both are good enough to beat Denver and can play a style to beat Denver, you shrink it, right? It's not, you can't just have a rum-dum team play the style that gives Jokic trouble. That's not going to be enough. You've got to be good and play that style. So it's just narrowing the odds you run into one of those teams. Yeah, this team is fairly young. And, you know, I wrote about this in the Dunks yesterday. I don't know if you had a chance to read this or look at my trivia question going in. But, yeah, there have been very few coaches who've taken as long as Michael Malone has on a job to get to the NBA Finals. This team still seems behind him. They still seem to, by all accounts, like, believe in his message, listen to his message. Like, you know, I don't think it's just him ruling with an iron fist. But the coach is a natural leadership role. And for him to maintain this message this long and have everybody buy in without them seeing it pays off with a trip to the finals, without them knowing they could get that until now, you know, I think he's set up to be there very long term. However, I suppose if they blow this series, that could bring in a lot of questions. But if they win, I think he's set up to be there a long time. And you know, Jokic is, it does not seem to be the type of star looking to move. He's locked in. Like, this team is built to last pretty well.
They are, and we'll see if ownership is willing to spend or how much that actually matters, because they have a lot of their guys locked in for a while now, and the cap is going to move up, you know, move up enough to give them some breathing room. I hope they're willing to, especially they're a championship caliber team that may win a championship in, let's call it, a week or 2 weeks' time. Plenty more to discuss with Dan Feldman, but first a message from FanDuel. Make a fast break to FanDuel during the NBA playoffs, because right now new customers can get a no-sweat first bet up to $1,000. That's $1,000 back in bonus bets if your first bet does not win. I think it's really cool that they have the combination now of team-specific stuff. Sure, you can do the over-unders and all that, but also player props. And player props can be a fun way if you think, oh, this is a great matchup for Jokic or whatever player that you can get. I mean, Jamal Murray has his ups and downs. You can do all that through FanDuel, and that's why there's no better place to bet all the playoff action than America's number one sportsbook. Visit FanDuel.com/Boston and get a no-sweat first bet up to $1,000. That's FanDuel.com/Boston, B-O-S-T-O-N, FanDuel, official sports betting partner of the NBA. Must be 21 and over in select states. First online real money wager only. $10 deposit required. Refund issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 14 days. Restrictions apply. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. FanDuel is offering online sports wagering in Kansas under an agreement with Kansas Star Casino LLC. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit FanDuel.com/RG. 1-800-NEXT-STEP or text NEXTSTEP to 53342. 1-888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org/chat. 1-800-9-WITH-IT. 1-800-522-4700 or visit ksgamblinghelp.com. 1-877-770-STOP, gamblinghelplinema.org, or you can call 1-800-327-5050 for 24/7 support in Massachusetts. Visit mdgamblinghelp.org, 1-877-8-HOPE-NY, or text HOPE-NY, 1-800-522-4700, or visit 1-800-GAMBLER.net. Let's go, you brought up like championship coaches and Michael Malone security. Let's go to the coaching carousel. I don't want to dwell on this in part because it's a lot of discussion in the abstract. What stood out to you now with Frank Vogel getting hired on Friday with the Phoenix Suns? Are there any of these hires that really stand out to you as being interesting, as being impactful?
Well, the Monty Williams hire in Detroit is, just so impactful in terms of the coaching market. For him to get that type of contract is just, I think it's going to recalibrate everything. That's just so huge.
And when we saw the money that Ishbia ended up having to pay to Vogel to functionally replace Monty Williams, like that at least it didn't adjust it then. It might take, there are situations like this where the last big hire ends up being the big one. So it takes a year for the market to recalibrate, though we could see some extension negotiations for coaches that shift in tenor a little bit based on this. That wouldn't surprise me at all. Also worth noting that coach salaries are distinctly not public a lot of the time, or distorted, or whatever else is there. Like, it's not, there isn't a, Spotrac or whatever, all the other ones that have existed, public and non-public, with coaches the same way. Williams, the reason why I was really encouraged by it, I was surprised he wasn't more firmly in the mix with the Sixers, is he is a much better coach than I expected the Pistons to hire. And I don't know that the benefits of having a much better coach will be as present early on, but they could be. Like, the question that I'm fixated on now with Detroit, and of course this is before their offseason and Troy Weaver could change their direction in about five different ways between now and then, is I like the idea of Monty Williams having this long of a contract and having the incentive to build this foundation. And they have a great young player in Cade Cunningham and a lot of other interesting pieces that hopefully we will get a better evaluation of now that they have Monty Williams in the fold. So how much changes right away, and whether it's the having a long-term coach, like you could think about Brad Stevens was the last person, it appears, to have gotten a contract this long as a new hire. Does that give the Pistons more or less latitude to be patient? Because they gave Bogdanovich an extension, but he is very tradable on that if they wanted to. Alec Burks, I presume they're going to pick up his team option. They could keep him, they could trade him. And I don't know how to interpret the data points that we have right now, but I'm also extremely confident that we will be able to interpret those data points in, let's call it a month.
Are you sure? Because they kept insisting that they're being totally patient while doing things like signing Kelly Olynyk and signing Mason Plumlee and trading for Alec Burks. Like, I don't know. They send mixed messages, so I don't know if we'll have a clear vision, but I don't think this changes the patient's plan. I think they want to see steps forward next year toward, really, really competing for the postseason. And they, that probably includes the play-in tournament. I don't think they're going to overreact to, if they lose in the play-in tournament. I think they'd see that as a sign of progress. And depending how it goes, maybe they should, maybe they shouldn't, right? If that's driven by Bogdanovich and Alec Burks and older players, and you're losing in the play-in tournament, that's probably not great. If it's driven by Cade Cunningham and Jalen Duren and Ivy, that's fantastic. I think just above Monty Williams, and really to a degree above Troy Weaver, you've got an owner in Tom Gores who hasn't won there. You've got a fan base that is very fair weather and has disengaged as the team has continued to lose. But also there are no other winners in the city and would come. When I say fair weather, that's just not negative. It's also a very strong fan base when the team is winning even a little bit. That would come back in droves if the team starts to win. So I just think there's an organizational readiness to win. And Monty Williams is a good coach, so he can help with that. And I don't think they're going to try and do it at all expenses. I think there's still some desire to develop those young players, and Monty Williams, again, should be able to help with that, too.
The other coaching hire, and this one will be more in season, that I'm really focusing on is Nick Nurse with Philly, because there are so many elements that we think of as like a coach's calling card, or this is what they've done, that we don't really get the opportunity to see whether that was context dependent or that was the coach. And with Nick Nurse, highly regarded, even if some of the shine has come off since 2019, getting to be a part of a dramatically different roster. Joel Embiid and everyone else, whether it includes James Harden or not, this is a very different set of players than what he had in Toronto at any point in time. So how much of what we've seen tactically from Nick Nurse is, well, you have this bunch of, you know, 6 foot seven rangy wings that also can't really do a lot with the ball in their hands, or like, are, you know, not dynamic offensively. How much of that is Nurse adjusting to his personnel, and how much of that is the way he wants to play and he'll try to do that with Philly?
It goes both ways too, because, you know, these 76ers players, especially Joel Embiid and James Harden, how much do they play how they've played because that's what their coaches ask of them, or how malleable are they? It starts with a willingness, but then there's also an ability. These 76ers have looked very different than Nurse's Raptors teams, and I'm curious how much bend there is in both directions. Absolutely.
On the malleability front, again, another thing that we'll probably never get an answer for, because I don't think it's a significant factor in the equation, is how Nick Nurse changes James Harden's thought process. Like, is it a circumstance, he's a championship level coach, but he asks a lot of his players, and we don't necessarily know how much freedom Harden would get. And does that change things? Does it not? Is it, you know, a new opportunity? It's not Doc Rivers. It sounds like that relationship was not the best. But generally speaking, my experience on these things, having projected successfully and unsuccessfully key free agents' decisions a lot over the years, both in mock off-season form and otherwise, is generally that's not a key determinant in why a player chooses a destination.
Yeah, I mean, I will say this about Nick Nurse, is he's not Doc Rivers, so I think that that helps for keeping Harden in Philly. Beyond that, yeah, I don't know. You could definitely see Nurse wanting a style that asks more of Harden, to exert himself more, to move more without the ball, to, you know, and Harden resisting that. You could also see Nurse's communication problems late in Toronto and Harden being wary of that. But on the other hand, you could also see Harden saying, my best chance to win a championship is continuing to play with Joel Embiid, for a coach who's already won a championship.
Okay, one last question on this front, and you could argue it's a little bit unfair, but I don't care. As somebody who watches the whole NBA and cares about whatever you want to prioritize, would you rather have Harden on the Sixers for the next 3 years or the Rockets?
Rockets.
Why?
Rockets for sure. So I am a far bigger believer than you and Nate, and I enjoy when a team has an identity with players built up over time. James Harden is a stranger on the 76ers. He is at home on the Rockets. I understand he left, but coming back, and first of all, you know, so that's number one. You know, I love Damian Lillard on the Trailblazers. I like Bradley Beal on the Wizards. Like, I don't get more enjoyment necessarily by seeing, like, Bradley Beal on a better team. You know, I like that he's doing what he can to help the Wizards, and I love Damian Lillard doing what he can, whatever he can, to drag up the Trailblazers, because if it works, like, if somehow you overcome the odds, it is so satisfying, it's so gratifying of a way to win. Look at Dirk in 2011 and Giannis with the Bucks. Like, those were some of the most awesome individual championships I've seen. So I like that. On top of that, I think it'd be a cool experiment with Harden, you know, trying to accelerate the Rockets timeline a little bit, and how they handle that with all their young players. They could go a couple different ways. They could say, look, we're just going to try and be how much ever better we could be with Harden, and let these young players grow on their timeline. They could try and flip some of those young players to be on Harden's timeline. I think both of those would be reasonable, depending on what, you know, returns are available. And then Philadelphia, you know, Daryl Morey, all-time great GM. I think he's at his best when he has a lot of room to tinker. So if you just say, hey, you know, you've got not a complete blank slate, but far more of a blank slate around Joel Embiid, go ahead and work your magic and try and work around the margins and build this team back up. I think that'd be super interesting. For me, it's definitely more interesting with him in Houston.
I agree with you, but the biggest reason why is one that I know you thought of, but you didn't mention, which is, I just don't think the Sixers with Harden are good enough to do what I want. Like,
I disagree.
Yeah, I think this
is what we were talking about with the Nugget. Like, I mean, it's easy to say for the Nuggets now that there were, you know, three games from a championship. But when I talk about being in the mix year after year after year, like, I think that's where the 76ers are with Harden and Embiid, and it hasn't gone well. And so, like, sometimes when you're in the mix, you're going to be the team where it goes poorly over and over until it doesn't. I think that team is good enough and
perfect. But I'm not encyclopedic on this. You're far better than I am. Have the Sixers even ever lost to the eventual champion? Like, it doesn't it doesn't seem like they're... And I'm also just part of it is, and you're right, it might be a parallel with the Nuggets. I'm just not a believer in the theory of that. And the other reason why I support it, you mentioned this, but I'll give it a little bit more emphasis. The Sixers have an underrated amount of flexibility if Harden leaves over the next couple of years. They could theoretically augment that by negotiating the Harden thing as a sign-and-trade, which wouldn't stun me. I mean, they'd probably have to send a small resource to Houston for that purpose, but I don't think it would be like a first-round pick. It would be, you know, maybe a second and a young player who's vaguely interesting. Not that they need more like Jaden Springers, but, you know, maybe. And so you do something like that because whether it's through it or you even just fold in the other, if Daryl Morey's doing it this July, you fold in the other transaction if you've lined it up. Like, that's the other thing you can do. It could be a totally unrelated one. But the other possibility is that Tobias Harris' contract is expiring. They actually have very little on their books for 24-25. They could theoretically just get that player in free agency. And my prediction would be, as great as Joel Embiid is, not only because of the age potential, but also the skill set meshing, kind of defensively, offensively, those guys are great together, of course. I think you might be able to get something. I don't know that it ends up being better. Maybe this is sort of like the parallel of you fire a coach and then you end up with a different coach who may not be better. But I would be excited about another roll of those dice while Joel Embiid is still this great.
Yeah, I mean, and it doesn't have to be one player. You could have something more balanced as you pursue that. In 2019, for posterity, the 76ers lost to the eventual champion Raptors.
Okay, that's right. Bounce.
In a hard-fought seven-game series, I bet the 76ers wish they had Jimmy Butler back.
Yeah, one good thing. But, like, for example, I don't want to get too deep into 24 free agency, but, you know, like, if I'm trying to think about who would be that player for them that would be really, really juicy. It could even be DeJounte. Like, I don't love the DeJounte Murray, but, like, I mean, it's probably not going to be Jaylen Brown. I think he's going to sign an extension. The other thing is, like, the Sixers would have the resources that they could theoretically do it through a trade rather than outright free agency.
Yeah, I mean, Jaylen Brown is probably more likely to change teams in 2024 than 2023.
Yeah, I mean, for personality reasons, a Siakam and Embiid met combining would be hilarious. Considering the, I mean, if you had Siakam and Embiid and Nurse, and be like, am I getting overrun here? But the spacing on that would be a little bit wonky and everything else. But again, like, they would be in the mix for good players, and Joel Embiid's an unbelievable talent, and I think they could draw something involved there. So where I want to end with this kind of ties in with Jaylen Brown and James Harden and everything else is I wrote a piece for The Athletic that came out on Thursday about the dynamic in 23 that there isn't this like clear cut, you know, headliner. If you want to go like Kevin Durant over the years or Kawhi or obviously LeBron when he made the decision and a few other times since. Not only is that the case, but also in part because of some of the flaws of these players and their ages and everything else, like there's genuine uncertainty about who of the unrestricted free agents will sign for the most guaranteed money. And I use guaranteed money because then, you know, because some of these might have downside projections for the teams, and that's fine. Who do you think it's going to be?
James Harden.
That's fair.
He's got the leverage from the Rockets, the external leverage. He's got a ton of internal leverage with the 76ers because it would be very difficult to replace him. As much as I just said I'd love to see Daryl Morey's creativity in that situation, it would require a lot of creativity and probably a step back, which is a dangerous thing to do in Joel Embiid's prime because with his health issues, you never know how long his prime is going to last. And beyond that, you just don't want to waste a year of it, even if he has a normal length prime. So I just think Harden has that combination. Harden's my pick, but I enjoyed your piece and I thought there were several viable candidates that you went over well.
Kristaps Porzingis' candidacy does seem weaker with Michael Winger getting the job in Washington, because he might have the latitude to not let them get leveraged in the way that the Wizards have it. And also, like, I brought this up in the piece, but, like, Porzingis does not have the equity within the organization that Wall and Beal did when they signed their massive deals. Like, that's just, it's just not, it's not an apples-to-apples comparison. But what's so weird about Porzingis is there are certain reasons why you could say, oh, man, like, he could definitely have a market. He is the youngest of all of the real candidates to, he's the youngest on the board. He's the only one where you're getting, like, real prime years, but also, like, Harden and Kyrie, both of those guys, their best year, this was Porzingis' best season at the NBA. He still didn't make an All-NBA team. The other guys have had much better success before, and we know the NBA is a star-driven league, not only in terms of, like, attendance, but also in terms of, you know, winning. And so for Porzingis, the other problem is just positional scarcity, that not only in the league more broadly, but among the cap space teams more specifically. Like, I think the Orlando Magic would love to get a player of Kristaps Porzingis' talent. And if they could do so without sacrificing important things, they would do it. However, that player being 7'3" doesn't move the needle as much for them as if that player was a dynamic guard. So I think that his place in it, and I've gone, for a lot of this year, I thought the guy was going to be Fred VanVleet, in part because he doesn't have the baggage that a lot of these guys do. You know, he's a guy who competed on the Raptors, whatever surrounding talent was there, but free agency is a lot about falling in love, and if you don't think that he's going to be that, like, star, if you think he's more of a complimentary player, that, you know, does a team go to, like, even close to his max for that? Maybe. I'm not sure. And then the other wild card in this, just speaking more broadly, and you've, of course, written about this well, you know it extremely well, is how we factor in bird rights and the new collective bargaining agreement, which has not been fully reduced into writing, but we have a pretty good idea of the contours. And so Chris Middleton, another player kind of like VanVleet, who can play everywhere, who can fit in, and he had this weird year with injuries and everything else like that, but the reason why I don't think it's going to be him is because it just gets too tough for Milwaukee. If Milwaukee is the team that pays Chris Middleton enough for him to get the most guaranteed money, I don't know how their books work beyond this. Maybe ownership, including some new ownership, is just willing to spend that. But it would surprise me.
I think one of the most under-discussed stories... Well, first, let me say this. The biggest shocker of this entire podcast is, you said, the real wild card is... And you didn't say Kyrie Irving. But I think the most under-discussed... one of the most under-discussed things is the Bucks are facing the repeater tax next year.
Yeah, didn't you? Aren't there, like, you? Because we haven't talked about this too much publicly. How many teams are potentially facing the repeater tax for the first time next year?
Yeah, so we've got the Warriors would be back in it. The Clippers would finally be in it. Everybody talks about them as a big spending team, but it takes a few years to get up there. The Nets would be in it. I imagine they're going to duck out, but I thought they would have ducked out this year, so you never know. The Lakers would be in it. They'll probably be in it. And then the Bucks. The Bucks would be in it, and I think if they're still trying to win around Giannis, they're probably going to be in the tax too. So I think the reason I'd go against Chris Middleton is I think what you're saying is the Bucks. I do think he'll re-sign with the Bucks, though he might not. But I think the Bucks have a lot of incentive to negotiate hard on this, not just to say, hey, we value you, we'll give you the max, like, we want to show we appreciate you, because sometimes that's how it goes. I think there's a lot of incentive to try and save every dollar. And I also, if I'm remembering right, there was a previous contract where it seemed like Chris Middleton could have gotten the max and took slightly less to stay with the Bucks. And so I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, it's just a harder negotiation from the Bucks side and a softer negotiation from Middleton's side. And he still gets a lot of money, but maybe not quite as much as he could.
Are there any other Middleton suitors that you find especially compelling?
I mean, Houston, Detroit. I mean, I don't know if I find them particularly compelling. They're just there. I'll tell you, one free agency, Kelly Eka wrote about the Rockets targets, and he put Brook Lopez on there, and I hadn't really thought about Brook Lopez to the Rockets, but, like, wow, what would the Bucks, like, I think they're probably game planning in for having to pay Middleton a lot of money, but what would they do if Brook Lopez gets a giant offer? And, like, maybe Brook Lopez would take less to stay in Milwaukee, right? He's going to be on the winner of the team he knows and is comfortable with. I don't think necessarily the Bucks are going to pay him the most money. But they probably got to come close at least. And what if he gets what if the Rockets are like, we want to be better now. We've got this money to spend. Brook Lopez, I think, is still a very underrated player. What if he's just paid, like, I know you like him too. I think you'd agree with me he's underrated. What will the Bucks do if a team offers Brook Lopez what you and I think he's worth?
It would be a problem. I mean, like, so let's say Houston throws $20 million a year, even if it's for 2 or 3 years at him.
Higher.
Yeah, it's very possible.
I mean, what if the Bucks kept him for $20 million a year, wouldn't you say, yep, got to do it? Like, that's not... based on how we value him.
Sure.
You and I, like, let's say $26 million a year.
Yeah, that overall bill for Milwaukee gets ridiculous. And there's all... I mean, another factor in all of this... is these players, when you hit free agency, and I've never explicitly talked with the player about it, I need somebody who is really open with their emotions to discuss this about them, I think you reevaluate, Ben Golliver and I have discussed it as basketball mortality, but you can also think about it in a bunch of different ways. You evaluate your options really differently when it's actually in front of you. And that could lead to you being like, I think this is my theory, is this is what's going to happen with Brooke. Is I'm happy here. I haven't been happy everywhere. So why am I going to worry about $5-10 million when I'm making plenty? But it can go the other way of I'm excited for a new opportunity. I'm excited to see what this is. And for me, one of the most prominent with that, tying back to a team we discussed at the very beginning of the podcast, was Paul Millsap with Denver. Like, or you could go with Jeremy Grant in Detroit, leaving Denver. Yeah. Like both of those. And I don't think that's the case. Because especially like the Bucks are still a very good team, and I don't think players generally worry about, oh, well, how good are we going to be 3 years from now? You worry about how good you are now, because who knows if you're going to be, even if you sign a 4-year contract, who knows if you're going to be in your place 3 years from now? So
yeah, I guess I don't know if you mean the same thing, but I think a lot of times when a player decides where to sign, it's a snapshot of how he's feeling at the moment, and I'm not sure they're always like... thinking through what that's going to mean, because a lot of times you think like, well, I'm here, you know, like the NBA player,
sure,
supremely confident, like, we're not going to lose a lot, like, I'm here. It's one thing to kind of think like, okay, I'm probably taking a step back by going from a team like the Bucks to the Rockets. I think it's not uncommon for us to see somebody sign for a lot of money with a team that clearly looked like it was going to be a downgrade in team quality, and then the player finding out actually living day to day of being on a bad team, finding it far more miserable than he expected.
Very possible. And Harden potentially could be, but I think Harden having the ball in his hands all the time, he might just be happy with that. Like,
yeah, I think he knows a little bit more of what he's getting. But yeah, he also would very much fall into the, well, I'm here now category too. So
he definitely would. And yeah, we should definitely talk about Kyrie Irving here. And an element of the Kyrie Irving story that is so different from a lot of these is, you know, very talented guy, there are some foibles. Like, I mean, I talked about this a little bit, like how not this year was hard to evaluate because he changed teams and everything else, but like there were some of those Nets teams where when he was the sole creator, their offense wasn't actually great, but he's still a dynamic talent, has still had some real high highs. So there are two elements that feed together. One of them is, I've said before that if I were running a team, I would not be in the Kyrie Irving business personally. If he wants to take the minimum, sure, like I would be in it. But outside of that, I just don't want to do it. Like if that is a real sacrifice, and I'm an aggressive pragmatist. It's just that's how I am with him. And really, honestly, among players, like there aren't that many other guys like that. What teams, if any, actually feel that way? What teams take themselves out of consideration? And that matters because of the internal versus external leverage with Irving. So there is obviously leverage when it comes to the Lakers, because, and Irving can credibly say this because he has taken less in the past, that the Lakers can't offer what the Mavericks can. There's no credible way to argue any differently. That he would be willing to take less. But then the question becomes, like, as Dallas, how credible do you find that threat? Not because, so the way you phrase it is not because, like, that's, you know, an invalid threat. It's, oh, so if it's 12 million different, you would do it. But if it's 8 million different, then you would stay. Like, that is a weird negotiating tactic. And the reason that matters is because if nobody else is firmly in the mix, like, it affects the final number, and of course it affects his destination.
Yes. I'm curious how creative the Mavericks would be on his contract. I think the weird thing is almost everybody accepts, like, oh yeah, you get, just because out of respect of who he is and his name and what he's accomplished and his obviously insanely high talent level, there just seems to be like a common understanding he's a max player. Now, he could accept less to go to the Lakers, but then he's got to get like every last dollar available, which probably makes sense at the point of what every last reasonable dollar is available to the Lakers. But the sense I get is just like, okay, you got to start with the max and then you can kind of work from there. To me, if that really is the case, if I'm the Mavericks, I'd probably be offering something where it's, and this is why I didn't have him at the top of my prediction for most guaranteed money, but maybe where it's like a rolling guarantee based on how many games he played the previous year. And you can make that a pretty low threshold, right? You're just trying to avoid some disaster. And yeah, just make it like, you could even push for like, look, we'll give you the 5-year deal, but only 1 year is going to be guaranteed. And you got to play, 50 games in the year prior, and then the next year is guaranteed. Like, it doesn't have to be anything ridiculous. And, you can frame it in a way of like, we're not trying to insult you or anything. We just got to protect ourselves a little bit. And we expect you to play 50 games. And we expect you to play out this contract. And this is not, it's not some benchmarks where Kyrie Irving can mostly do the right things and still fail. Like, if he's doing the right things, he's going to get it all guaranteed.
It's also, like, along those lines, how does Kyrie Irving and his representation, how do they feel about assessing risk? Is it, is circumstances like that? Does he say, oh, I'm obviously going to play 25 games? Like, that's not a danger, like, I can do to move forward. Or if a team right. like the Lakers or, let's say, the Orlando Magic, like, Kyrie Irving would fundamentally change the Orlando Magic. Like, they could give them an offensive bullet. Like, if all they did was like clear the salary necessary to pay him, whether it's the max or less than the max, I think they have a pretty good shot of making the playoffs next year, potentially even making a little bit of noise, depending on where things, I mean, the top of the East is very strong. But are they interested at all? And are they, and where do they see all these things? And so he's the hardest to predict for so many reasons. Also, Irving, it falls by the wayside a little bit. Like, it's, everybody knows that he's left so many situations, but like, one of the elements that makes Kyrie Irving fundamentally different is he's left situations where at least the team was competitive basically every time. Like, this was, like, he made his way out of Cleveland, he made his way out of Boston, and Brooklyn, it gets complicated in terms of, I mean, they were both pushing each other out the door kind of in some ways. Or like the Nets were pushing him and he was not pushing back. And all of those teams at least had a conceptual championship argument, but he hasn't been, he hasn't been like had the freedom of choice in a while. What does he value? And how does he evaluate these Mavericks? Because they had a weird segment of the season where he was there. And Luka's a great talent, and they have, they have a coach who was a former point guard and everything else. And so we will learn a lot. Let's put it that way.
My rooting interest is that he leaves, one, because the chaos would be fun, and two, because he says this is a team with a losing culture that tanked, and I don't stand for that.
It's possible.
I don't want that reward. I want that punished. I hate that. I understand it might have been the right choice. I hate that it might have been the right choice. Anything anybody wants to do to make the Mavericks regret that, I'm all for.
Anything else you want to discuss?
That's good.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Dan Feldman for taking the time to come on. You can read his excellent work and often listen to it as well with the Daily Dunks and audio Daily Dunks that are part of Dunked on Prime. He does such excellent work, and Dan has a much better savvy and, I guess you could say, bandwidth for going through, especially the text stuff. So, like, I actually generally, a lot of what I read is from what he puts together for the Daily Dunks. He does such a great job there of what is newsworthy and what is worth reading. You can also follow him on Twitter at Dan Feldman NBA, DanFeldmanNBA. If you want to support Real GM Radio, there are a lot of different ways you can do it. You can subscribe, download every episode, whatever podcast player you use, Apple, Spotify, wherever. Really appreciate it. You can also help other people find the show. That can be word of mouth, social media, or leaving a rating and review in the podcast player of your choosing. But the most important thing you can do for this podcast and any other that has them is to check out our sponsors. For us, that is FanDuel. FanDuel.com/Boston. And you get that no sweat first bet up to $1,000. Of course, talked about that earlier. You can also check out my other work. As mentioned, Dan is a part of the Dunked On Prime family as well. Nate and I are going strong, not only with our breakdowns of the games, but also off-season previews and draft prospect scouts, and then all the other benefits for Dunked On Prime, including Dan's Daily Dunks, Seth Partnow's Nerd Noshes, the pods John does, or Nate does with John Hollinger, and Discord chats, a lot of other cool stuff. So hopefully you can check it out. We're actually doing a sale in honor of the mock-up season, which is, of course, coming later on in June. You can also check out my other work. As Dan and I discussed, I have a new piece out at The Athletic talking about free agency. I'll continue to do things throughout this window, either collaboratively, like I did a piece with Tim Kawakami on the Warriors, or solo. Also, Nate and I are going to be doing, let's say, every planned game for the NBA Finals on Playback, which has been great. You can check that out. We tweet it out pretty consistently. It's a great way to watch. A little bit more constrained right now for American viewers due to they're working through some stuff with the NBA license, but at least you can sync up, but there are other ways you can check it out. If you have any feedback, good, bad, or indifferent, DannyLaRueNBA@gmail.com is the way to get it to me. If you take the time to write it, I will take the time to read it. That is an absolute promise. And my replies aren't always the greatest. This is a very busy time for me in so many ways. And I love a lot of this. I mean, it's the finals and draft scouting and working through off-season prep and everything else like that. But it is a very busy one. So thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.